Wasabi Wallet, unfairly private.
What is going on, everyone? Welcome to the show. I hope you're having a good week. I continue to do the show live from Greece. I'm currently on the island of Corfu, and we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff that's been going on this past week. We're going to touch, of course, a little bit on the infrastructure bill, because that's been going crazy this past week and finally kind of came to an end, I guess. We had a resolution of what actually happened with it. We're going to touch on AMC accepting Bitcoin, going down that route, and is 30% of global hash moving to my home province of Alberta? I'm going to touch on all of that. Of course, please do hit like, subscribe, and share. That really helps get this content in front of more eyeballs. Let's get this thing rolling. I am Ben with the BTC Sessions. This is your daily session. Bitcoin. Before we dive in, of course, shout out to sponsors of the show, Ledin.io, where you can use your Bitcoin for a variety of different services on their fancy new design website. Nice work, guys, there. But if you need to get your hands on dollars and you don't want to sell your Bitcoin to do so, because, of course, taxable event, may have to buy back in at a higher price, you can use their Bitcoin backed loans to get dollars into your bank account within 24 hours. And when you pay back those dollars, you get back the same amount of Bitcoin that you initially deposited. They, of course, have their savings accounts and their B2X offerings that you can check out. Links are down below. If you click that link and use it to get a loan product, they'll give you $25 for free into your savings. If you're stacking sats in Canada, BitBuy is a super easy way to do so. They have their web interface and their dedicated app for iOS and Android. They're no joke when it comes to security, yearly proof of reserve audits. And of course, after your first $250, they will give you $20 for free. Now, I live on Bitcoin. One of the things that really helps me with this is BitRefill. You can get any gift card you can imagine here. It's available in just a ton of countries, and you earn sats back as you shop. You can purchase using Bitcoin on-chain or Lightning Network, which I regularly do. And as I said, you earn sats back while you shop. They also have a pretty good referral program. So if you got friends and family interested, you can get some kickbacks from that as well. The Keystone, I've done a recent tutorial on, formerly Kobo Vault. I love this thing. Hardware wallet, fully offline via air gapping. That means that nothing is done via plugging into an actual internet connected device. It's all QR code. It's got just all the bells and whistles that you can more than you can shake a stick at. And of course, it works with all of my favorite wallets, things like Wasabi and Blue Wallet and Sparrow and Spectre. It just runs the gamut. So check it out. Links are down below. And finally, of course, if you're backing up any important wallet with any meaningful amount of funds, get that backup on something other than paper. I use the Bitfoddle in solid steel over at privacypros.io, and it just kind of gives you peace of mind when it comes to fire damage, water damage, or somebody just accidentally discarding it if they don't know what it is. I've heard some horror stories the past couple of years, so be sure to check them out. With that, let's dive into the news. Now, I want to touch on this story. It was covered on the CBC. Bitcoin Magazine did a little write-up about it, about BlackRock Petroleum, not to be confused with BlackRock, the company, the asset manager. They are looking to install, allegedly, 1 million Bitcoin miners in Alberta, in my home province here. So I'm going to read a little bit here from this article here. Nevada-based BlackRock Petroleum Company has entered into an agreement with Optimum Mining Host to deploy and operate up to 1 million Bitcoin mining machines. So already, you know, it could be up to this much, but we'll see. These miners would be hosted in Alberta and sourced from China, per a press release issued in July that this week received new attention from the CBC, Canada's largest public media company. Now, I was contacted by somebody from the CBC and from another news organization the past couple days. In fact, the author of this Peace himself contacted me for comment. I was in the midst of travel. I couldn't get back to him in time, so the piece already went live. The piece itself, there's a few negative things in there in terms of things that don't really line up as to how a lot of this works. Some negative, environmental FUD, whereas if they're tapping into natural gas, typically it's waste gas that's the most profitable here, which actually reduces emissions. So I digress. Let's keep going here. BlackRock's proposed mining operation would span three natural gas producing sites located in Alberta. The first 200,000 machines would be deployed at the Cork Creek gas plant, a recently announced plant acquisition by BlackRock. The firm has planned to allocate 300,000 machines to a second site in Alberta, with the remaining 500,000 allotted to a third site yet to be identified. The CEO commented that the Cork Creek property is perfectly situated to service those markets. Current production levels are good, and our engineers have looked at the property's historical production records and analyzed these recent reserve evaluations, and we are confident we have the expertise, technology, and resources to materially increase production and in turn the cash flow of the site, and to host and operate Bitcoin miners at an energy cost of circa 3 cents Canadian per kilowatt hour. Now they did note that the optimum mining contract is 2 years with an option to extend by 12 months with notice. No timeline has been established for this deal. Now the other thing, the number here, 1 million miners. If this were to actually take place, it would be in line, and they note it here at the end of the article, this would be 1/3 of the current global mining capacity. And I'm pretty skeptical that that's coming to Alberta. I mean, I would love for a bunch of mining capacity to come to Alberta. I think that would be fantastic for my home province. I think it would be an economic boon here. But I'm skeptical, already at the beginning of the article, they're saying up to this many. Now, there's another quote here. The president of Caledonian Midstream Corporation commented, given our current gas production, a more reasonable number of miners would be 10,000 rather than the 200,000 referenced in the press release. And they said that the logistics of bringing such a large number of mining rigs to Alberta, to rural Alberta, would be challenging. So in general, I think it would be positive to see more hash power come to Alberta, but I will remain skeptical of this project until I actually see it come to fruition. So, the more the merrier, but let's wait and see. Maybe don't get too excited yet. Let's touch on AMC. AMC says it will accept Bitcoin as payment for movie tickets by year end. A couple notes here. CEO Adam Aron said during an earnings call Monday that the movie theater chain will have the IT systems in place to take the cryptocurrency as payment by the end of 2021. The price of Bitcoin's blah, blah, blah. They get into some. Okay, so let's read a little bit here. I don't know about this article here. AMC Entertainment said Monday it will start accepting Bitcoin as payment for movie tickets and concessions if purchased online at all its U.S. theaters. The CEO said during an earnings call, as we just said, move marks a marriage between two highly speculative assets, Bitcoin, known for its wild volatility, and AMC, which became a meme stock favored by retail traders on Reddit's infamous Wall Street Bets forum. The rest of this is effectively just saying shit's volatile. So what does this amount to, this announcement? I personally think this is a big nothing burger, but it gets lots of play because two things in the news a lot, meme stocks and Bitcoin as of late. And so what does this actually mean for Bitcoin? Number one, okay, they said that they'll have the IT systems in place to take cryptocurrency by the end of 2021. Dude, what the fuck's taking you so long? It's like mid-August. Okay, how long does it really take to get that set up? Like, number one, they're probably going through a payment processor, right? That's what they're going to be doing. So what, you throw on, like, hopefully not BitPay. I'd prefer they use something like OpenNode that isn't trash. But okay, so they end up using a payment processor, probably. And what are they going to do with that? They're probably going to dump it. Like, realistically, I don't think they're sticking it on their balance sheet. And like, what percentage of payments is actually going to come from Bitcoin? Probably not a lot, to be honest. Like, it seems like an article out of 2015. Realistically, like, are we celebrating somebody saying, I'll accept another form of currency? It actually contributes to downward pressure on price if a lot of people were to utilize this and pay in Bitcoin for their movie tickets and then have that currency dumped on the market for dollars, right? I think in the end, what's going to happen is they'll just have the option and nothing else will really matter. They'll probably go through a payment processor. Now, what would change my mind about this story is if they said, actually, what we're doing is anybody that pays in Bitcoin, we are going to keep that. We're doing it via our own setup. We have our own BTC Pay server that is linked through our website, and you can pay through there via Bitcoin on-chain and Lightning, and anything that we receive goes into Treasury as Bitcoin. That would be an interesting story. But this, it just kind of seems like the CEO is like, oh shit, we have some money now because somehow we fell into the meme stock category. We have some liquidity. What's another thing that can make it seem like we're innovating and doing things? What's in the news? Bitcoin. Yeah, we accept Bitcoin now. That seems like it was the line of thinking. So I don't know. I'm not too excited about the story. I don't really give a shit. Let's keep moving here. Van Eck takes a new approach with the SEC and files for Bitcoin Strategy ETF. So asset manager Van Eck is filing for a Bitcoin Strategy exchange traded fund after it unsuccessfully attempted to launch a similar fund 4 years ago. According to the SEC, Van Eck filed a prospectus for a Bitcoin Strategy exchange traded fund on August 9th. Unlike its Bitcoin or Ether funds, which are currently under review by the agency, the proposed fund would not invest in Bitcoin directly, but provide exposure through Bitcoin futures contracts, pooled investment vehicles, and other exchange traded products. Van Eck said that the Bitcoin Strategy ETF would allow exposure through crypto ETFs listed and traded in Canada, and so on and so forth. It goes on from here. So effectively what is happening here is Van Eck already has proposed yet again for regular Bitcoin ETF, and actually I think an Ethereum one, which would just have direct exposure to it, which the US does not currently have a regular vehicle for people to easily access that in their market. Canada does. Canada has multiple Bitcoin ETFs that are very easy. You just go into your online banking and you can just purchase, or through something like, I can't remember the name because I don't use it. But there's, you know, Robinhood-esque apps here in Canada that you can use to get exposure to Bitcoin ETFs. So what happened here is the head of the SEC said, hey, the old way of filing that you guys keep filing through, it would be better if you went through a different framework to do this. You're more likely to get an approval. And so this prompted Van Eck to also file for this kind of not direct exposure to Bitcoin ETF that they're throwing on the table. I'm not as excited about something like this because, again, it's not settled in Bitcoin. It's no Bitcoin is trading hand. It's just speculating in dollars on the movements of Bitcoin. So I would prefer to see the other ETF reach approval. I mean, if they both do, fantastic. I do find it a joke that the States still does not have access to a Bitcoin ETF, given that the market clearly wants access to it, and they're doing anything in their power to just gain access, gain exposure through other vehicles. Like, MicroStrategy or Tesla just because they own Bitcoin, or going through brokers to get access to the Canadian market. There's or GBTC or other closed-end funds. All of those things are where people are getting access. Clearly, the market is getting that exposure through other vehicles. So why not just fucking give them what they want and make it easier? And it seems kind of ass backwards that they're just sitting on their thumbs. But hey, it'll hit eventually. Either way, you know, hold your own private keys, not your keys, not your coins. That's all I can say. Okay. Let's get into this. The Senate just rejected the compromise crypto tax amendment to the infrastructure bill. So effectively, what is going on is there's a huge infrastructure bill for the United States where they want to do a bunch of spending on a whole bunch of different stuff that was supposed to be infrastructure related. And last minute, they threw in a bunch of shit around Bitcoin and cryptocurrency that calls into question who is known as a broker and the responsibilities of which individuals may have in regards to KYC, AML, know your customer, anti-money laundering regulations, and reporting. So let me read a little bit from it and then we'll dive a bit deeper. Okay, so a bipartisan compromise amendment to the $1 trillion infrastructure bill regarding cryptocurrency tax reporting was rejected by the Senate Monday. The compromise amendment presented by a number of different senators would have clarified the definition of a broker who, under the current provision text, will be required to report crypto gains in a type of 1099 form. So the worry here, well, what's going to happen is effectively exchanges, if you're trading and everything on various exchanges, then that gets reported to the IRS so that they're privy to who has made money, okay? However, currently the bill defines a broker as, quote, any person who, for consideration, is responsible for regularly providing any service, effectuating transfers of digital assets on behalf of another person, which many advocates say are too broad statements. As written, it could potentially target miners, developers, stakers, and others who do not have customers and therefore wouldn't have access to the information needed to comply. So effectively, what's going on here is a lot of, like, miners, they don't know who's transacting. All their job is to compile a bunch of valid transactions that sit within the framework of the rules and the Bitcoin network and solve the proof of work puzzle and amend that new block of transactions to the Bitcoin blockchain so it becomes official. Somebody running a node effectively hosts a copy of all of these transactions and relays those transactions to other people in the network. Somebody running a Lightning node actually does route transactions through their node and in cases can retain fees, albeit small fees, for doing that service. There's a lot of instances where the language used in that specific bill would be it would be confusing and somebody could pursue action against somebody feasibly for not reporting on those facilitations of transactions. However, none of those people have any of the information necessary to report on that. So you could get into a situation where somebody routing Lightning transactions or routing transactions or mining may be requested to give KYC, AML, and various information on the transactions that they've routed that is literally impossible to comply with. And so what happens then, rather than risk that regulatory certainty that you may be in the wrong and you may face fines for doing so, business will just move external to the US. And so a lot of people within the US are concerned that basically this could, depending on how it's handled, could kill innovation in the US and just cause it to move elsewhere. For the Bitcoin network itself, Bitcoin doesn't give a flying fuck what a bunch of senators just passed in their ignorance. So in the end, I don't know. We'll see how it plays out, if anybody actually... So a couple things can happen. There's still room to change and amend that language later on before it gets passed into law. So there's still a little bit of time there. We'll see. But effectively, in its current form, as is approved, there's no clarification around that language. But realistically, again, Bitcoin will continue to work as it does. Lightning will continue to work as it does. It just may be that all of it happens outside of the US and your wallet just connects to something outside of the US and perhaps people in the US will just have a bit of a pain in the ass dealing with it for a period of time. until which so much of the industry moves abroad that the US is just forced to act and lighten things up. Who knows what will happen there. Now, I will say that in an unrelated note, I have a full tutorial on how to run a Lightning node and how to route payments. So if you feel like checking that out, it is available to you. You can just search Lightning Node on YouTube. It'll be the first thing that pops up. And it's a full hour long how to set up your Lightning Node. I do have a video on how to set up the Umbral Node, which this is running on. So be sure to check that out. You can even go on terminal.lightning and you can search up BTC Sessions and you can find my node. Feel free to open a channel to it. That's all good. There was a really good... drop from Jameson Lopp talking about Lightning liquidity and managing that. Now, it was pretty technical, so might be a little bit difficult to wrap your head around all of this. There, I do want to read a couple tweets from within it, though, from Alex Bosworth. He said, Lightning routing is a multifaceted competitive system. It's not just about capital. A brute force deployment of capital will cripple return on investment. The system models a distributed predictive cash. Available capital is a factor, but so is intelligent capital placement, reliability, and speed. If you're asking what is the return on investment on a routing node, you're operating from an incorrect premise of how Lightning functions. $1 billion can flow over a $5 channel. Managing to place and maintain that channel where $1 billion needs to flow is the really difficult part. So this goes into the details of in its current state, how to start to look at your Lightning node and see what capacity is being used and what's not, and how to reallocate capital rather than just connecting to all the big nodes. It's kind of counterintuitive, but you actually don't want to do that because they're already well connected. Where can you create connections between individuals or entities that previously would have had a harder time routing payments or had to go through a lot more hops to get there, when instead they could route through you? So that's an interesting one. And also, if you want to get into a group of people that are actively doing this and setting up routes and providing liquidity to each other, check out PlebNet. These guys are awesome. They continue to grow. KYCjelly.com is how you get there, and that will send you to their Telegram group and you can start chatting. They got a ton of stuff there. These guys have been absolutely killing it. I think I should probably do a WOB. I should probably do a Why Are We Bullish with some PlebNet people, and I think that'd be a good one. Anyways, let's keep going here. BitMEX announces $100 million CFTC and FinCEN settlement. So here, crypto derivatives trading platform BitMEX announced Tuesday it had reached a settlement on civil charges with the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, and Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN. BitMEX will pay a $100 million penalty to resolve the charges, the firm announced in a blog post, with $50 million going to the CFTC and the remainder to FinCEN. The blog post did not address the criminal charges filed by the Department of Justice against BitMEX CEO Arthur Hayes and other executives. A consent order in the CFTC case filed Tuesday found that BitMEX offered U.S. persons leveraged and unlicensed crypto products, a violation of federal law between 2014 and 2020. The firm's oversight systems were, quote, inadequate and lacked effective KYC and AML safeguards, the document said. So effectively what happened is they offered derivatives and leveraged trading to U.S. citizens without enough KYC and AML requirements to ensure that they weren't offering those things to U.S. citizens. Effectively, if you had, you could sign up with no ID, and if you just had a VPN running that showed you as being outside of the U.S., you could just have an account there and pretty much do whatever the hell they wanted. I don't think that this is anything to do with the best interest of U.S. consumers. It's more they just want their tax money, right? Because there's a lot of money rolling through BitMEX, billions and billions of dollars. So, this is more, hey, where's pay up? Pay the tax, man. And again, this settlement does not cover some of the enforcement that's going against the CEOs. So a spokesperson for Hayes and his fellow co-founders Ben Dello and Sam Reed told CoinDesk that the three were not involved in the settlement. As their defense, quote, as their defense will show, the company's earliest days, the co-founders sought to comply with applicable law as it developed over time. The actions against Arthur, Ben, and Sam by the U.S. authorities are unfounded and represent an unwarranted overreach. The co-founders look forward to defending themselves in court. Again, I'm not big on the regulation. I think it's a reach to say that they went above and beyond to ensure that they complied. Realistically, they just said, okay, we'll check your IP address, and as long as it's not from the States, then you're Gucci. So yeah, I don't know. We'll see what happens there. Let's keep going. Surprise, surprise, another DeFi hack. $600 million stolen again. All right, so in what may be the largest attack on decentralized finance, quote unquote, or DeFi, unknown hackers used an exploit on cross-chain protocol Poly Network to remove at least $600 million from three chains. According to a Tuesday update on Twitter, Poly Network said the attacks had removed assets from Binance Chain, Ethereum, and Polygon Network. Blockchain data from the respective networks shows hackers stole roughly $273 million from Ethereum, $85 million in USDC from Polygon, and $253 million from the Binance Smart Chain. Poly also reported that RenBTC, Wrapped Bitcoin, and Wrapped Ether were involved in the exploit, which used a vulnerability between contract calls. Effectively, you've got, again, an instance of people locking money up in an untested stuff and having their money siphoned away. This happens a lot when it comes to DeFi. We are seeing that a lot of it is less decentralized than is initially stamped on the name DeFi. Of course, the statement from Poly shows that there's specific figureheads that run the network or that are responsible for everything. You have the Binance Smart Chain, which is effectively run by Binance itself. Ethereum gave up on decentralization long ago by reverting the DAO hack in 2016 and the inability for anybody to run a node at all, really, at this point. Everything's over AWS. So yeah, I don't know. Like, we're going to see lots of this continued. Nobody seems to learn their lesson. It's just going to be a constant stream of buggy software built upon centralized software. That's about it. Now, let's get back into decentralization. I was talking about nodes earlier, and there's a massive update for Umbral. So if you're running an Umbral node, you've probably already noticed. Now, I haven't updated mine yet because I don't want to reset my Lightning name, my alias for my Lightning node right now while I'm abroad. I want to have access to it at home and everything. Anyways, they just updated Umbral to basically be a personal server operating system for everyone via this blog post. So this means that they've introduced a ton of stuff that's not just Bitcoin. Okay, so they said, starting today, Umbral isn't just a Bitcoin and Lightning node. It's a personal server OS that empowers anyone to reclaim full ownership and control of their data and become a truly self-sovereign citizen of the internet. With 10 brand new apps in the Umbral App Store, you can now run your own personal cloud with Nextcloud. You can host your photos and videos with PhotoPrism, passwords with Vault Warden, code repositories with Gitia, block ads on your entire home network with Pi-hole, automate your home with Home Assistant, run your own messaging server with Matrix, stream torrents with SimpleTorrent, and even code in VS Code on your Umbral with Code Server. So they've just they've loaded this thing up with so much stuff. I'm so excited to start playing with all of this. You can also now view your storage and RAM usage with complete app-by-app breakdown, along with your CPU temperature and uptime in the settings. Another thing I'm very excited to see. And they're also happy to announce that over the coming days, Umbral's source code will be relicensed under the Polyform Non-Commercial 1.0 license. We'll get into that in a moment. So effectively, this helps you kind of de-Google your life, where you're reliant on other people's computers to store your data. This helps you, again, host whatever you want, your cloud files, all of your pictures, videos, anything that you need can just be stored on a server connected to the internet, accessible from anywhere via your Umbral node, which is crazy. They also say that by default in the future, Umbral, as you download the software, will just come as a completely blank slate, because some people may want to use this just as a file server, right? Some people may not be using Bitcoin, and that's fine, but they'll have access to it if they choose to use it. I think this is a fantastic move from them. I'm very excited to see the cross-pollination that comes from this, because number one, you're going to get Bitcoiners that are going to say, I love the idea of not trusting others and kind of taking personal responsibility for my own Bitcoin transactions and my Lightning transactions and so on and so forth. So why not apply that to other aspects of my digital life? And then on the other hand, you're going to get people that may be coming from the other aspect of things saying, hey, I like being able to host my own stuff. I like being able to have my own personal storage for my digital life. Oh, look, I can run a Bitcoin node. I can run a Lightning node. Maybe I can start routing payments and doing things like that. That could be interesting. And so I think you're going to see a couple different worlds start to collide. And yeah, I'm very excited for that. Now, let's talk a little bit about this licensing thing here. I'm not going to get too deep into it, but there's a good chunk at the end that I want to read here. So it says, today with the release of Umbral version 0.4, we're taking a leap in making digital self-sovereignty accessible to the masses. We're also excited to announce that over the coming days, the source code will be relicensed to a new license, Polyform Non-Commercial 1.0, which is much more permissive and suitable than our current license. The too long didn't read is, if you don't intend to sell Umbral, Our new license grants you the same freedoms that come with an open source license. So the Umbral source code will remain public on GitHub as it always has been. Anyone can freely use, fork, modify, or distribute modifications of source code for personal and nonprofit purposes. Now, commercial purposes like selling plug-and-play hardware with Umbral or its derivatives continue to be prohibited. And then they say we'll continue to publish developer tools, libraries, and code packages under permissive open source licenses like MIT. They go into a lot of the history of open source and everything, but at the end, this is kind of the takeaway. This transition of new and existing open source projects to source available licenses indicates the start of a new era, but it doesn't indicate the end of open source and free software eras. Instead, all three kinds of licensing models will continue to coexist, and developers will get to enjoy more freedom and flexibility in deciding how their work is used. For software that needs additional layers of software to be built on top of it, like Bitcoin Core, LND, Bootstrap, so on and so forth, it makes sense for it to be freely licensed under permissive licenses like MIT. But for most consumer products, companies can now publicly publish their source code without worrying about predatory behavior. This especially is great news for makers of high-stakes software, where having the source code public is critical for security, like Bitcoin wallets, many of whom have already started to adopt source available licenses like Coldcard and Lily Wallet. By OSI's 30-year-old definition of open source, this new family of licenses are not open source since they impose some form of non-commercial restrictions, but it doesn't mean they're closed source or proprietary. Openness is a spectrum. Our new license grants nearly all freedoms that come with open source license to our users, such as the ability to view, modify, and redistribute the source code, while the non-commercial restriction allows us to build a path to sustainably fund the development of Umbral in the long term by exploring partnerships with plug-and-play hardware vendors and such. So early in the article, they talk about Luke Childs, who has done a ton of open source development previously, and a lot of his code has been used by major players like Netflix and Google and other huge companies, and has probably made them profitable to the tunes of millions, if not billions of dollars, but not much has flowed back to people that are creating these free and open source products. And so what these companies do is they'll take something that's free and open source and kind of just make it look pretty and then sell it, okay? And be able to say like, oh, you made this, I made this, and now I'm profiting off of it. What they're trying to do here is say, hey, we made this, we're gonna make it free for everybody, and we wanna make sure that nobody comes along and takes this and then tries to sell the work that we did for free for a profit, okay? And so that's what these new licensing things kind of do. At the same time, it reserves the right to them to say, maybe partner up with somebody who specializes in hardware and allow them to partner and say, hey, we'll partner with you and do a revenue share if you do want to sell pre-made boxes or something like that, which I think is totally fine. I think this is a good move in the right direction from them, as I understand it anyways. And again, people like Coldcard are doing this kind of thing where the code is open source. Now you can see everything and how it works from a security perspective, but it prevents, how should I, predatory is the way the term they say, I don't know, kind of, I don't know, vulture-like behavior. I get what they're trying to do is what I'm saying here. And, you know, it's more open source than not. And it prevents some of that predatory behavior where people can piggyback on their work and make a profit while they pump out stuff for free. So, yeah. couple last things I want to pitch for you guys to maybe spend some extra time watching later on. Petrodollars. This was awesome. It's like a 30-minute film put together by Richard James, and it's compiled with other stuff that has been put together by other people. The narrative is from an article by Alex Gladstein and put together and recorded by Guy Swan over at Bitcoin Audible. It also features clips from Alex Gladstein and interviews himself, and Nick Carter is in there. I heard him. There's a bunch of other stuff, but it's just put together so well, and it outlines the path of the US dollar and the petrodollar system that, in my opinion, sorely needs to be replaced. So that was an excellent watch. And another good one, if you haven't watched it yet, I know some people aren't super stoked on Breedlove at the moment, but this was an excellent listen. So Jordan Peterson, after hearing John Vallis host a book club on his book Maps of Meaning, he had on again, Richard James from the aforementioned video that I just told you to watch, Robert Breedlove, John Vallis, and Gigi. And they all came on and basically talked to him about Bitcoin. They talked to him about money in general and kind of the social implications of a sound money. And it was really awesome to watch him have these epiphanies of the implications of sound money, or a lack of sound money, on society that seems to line up with a lot of his previous work. Highly recommend you either listen to or watch this. It was excellent, and my hats are off to everybody that was in this video, because they did a great job explaining things, and it was a fantastic conversation to listen to. Anyways, guys, thank you so much for watching and or listening. If you're here on YouTube, please do hit like, subscribe, share. All of those things really, really do help, and they get this content in front of more eyeballs. If you want to help with the show in another way, you can hit up the previously mentioned sponsors down below. Ledin, BitBuy, BitRefill, Keystone, Bilfoddle, all of them are linked in the show notes. And if you really liked what you saw, you can head over to my Strike page. That is strike.me/BTC sessions. All you do is you type in any amount that you like, you hit the tip button down below, you will be greeted with a Lightning QR code, or if you go to the right, you'll be hit up with a regular Bitcoin QR code, and you can use that. I do have a Strike tutorial if you're so inclined. With that, I am out. Have yourselves a wonderful day or evening wherever you may be. I'll see you guys next time for your daily session.
Hold the Bitcoin.